This is Jan Cox, talk number 341, recorded on May 12th, 1988.
All right. Everyone, first look to the right, look to the left, and then, of course, now, don't you feel much better? I'm going to start off speaking about something I have used the term for before. And I didn't go into it much, and I did not go out in this direction. That was what I had referred to previously as the public and the private voice of man. And what I said that time, I said about a specific having to do with what seems to be the inclination to have a personal voice related to apparently out there, and then, of course, apparently related toward oneself. But now let me expand this quite correct notion of there being like a nice split in what is the upper circuit's noise. Now, you could look at it as being a private and a public voice, or several other things. I could look at it as being one's job as opposed to one's hobby. You could look at it as being called a battlefield as opposed to one's backyard. You could also look at it as being the difference between an actor with a script and then somebody just on their bloody own. Let me start off with the public and the private voice, and don't really try to confuse it, those of you who heard me mention this at one time in the past. It's like this, and all of you can feel it, all of you should have plenty of spare time observation and knowledge of this. There would seem to be in everybody, and then tied right to it, there would seem to be absolutely collectively a public voice. Let's call it one community, one tribe, our country right now, which, of course, we're just referring to, or I am, a certain part of life's body. But there would seem to be a predominant voice coming from that part of life's body. Nowadays, with communication being what it is, I guess it would normally fall under some general heading of it being a kind of political message or the political stance of some country. And so they could say the voice of America seems to say this in response to a lessening of the nuclear tensions in Western Europe, that this seems to be the American voice. And I don't mean just what the president or some leader has said, but that somebody in another part of life's body, or even right here with us part of life's body, seems to be making some observation for life that the people in general seem to have a certain attitude right now toward a certain thing. Now, you could look upon that as being the combined public voices of all the individual public voices. Now, let me see if I can drag you to the second possibility I point out, that you could look at as being the difference. Now, I'm still talking about the same thing. Imagine a two columns I drew, and I started out calling it the private voice and the public voice. Or I start off backwards, public and private. And now, in the left-hand column, it would say one's job. In the right-hand column, would say one's hobby. Now, there are things that people talk about, you individually and people collectively. But you individually, there are things that you talk about. There are things that apparently are important to you, but that you only talk about them publicly. Now, publicly does not simply mean that you're around a large group of people, or it does not mean that you're in your workplace all the time. It is a certain motivation that life runs through people. And one way to look at it is like this. Most people would not do the job they do unless somebody bloody well paid them. Therefore, the people, what I'm referring to now, the individuals would not be apparently thinking about or talking about this subject unless they're being paid to. Take a second. Maybe it's going to take more than a second. There are things that you apparently think, and you can put now think, slice, talk. Yellow circuit, higher level, higher circuit activity. There are things that you continually, or constantly at least, or periodically at least, think about and then talk about that apparently are serious. But if you look at it in the way in which I'm trying to point you towards tonight, if someone were not paying you to do it, you would never think about it. You would not talk about it. And yet at the time you do it, it is apparently serious, serious business. Now, when I say that the column could be reading job as opposed to hobby, it is more than an absolute, or it could be more than an absolute vocation. But if in some way you are not being paid, you would never talk about this. And yet at the time you seem to be talking about it, even if it's to yourself, it seems to be serious and weighty business. It is subject, of course, to another part of life's body that is not engaged or similarly engaged in your job at that time to poke fun at it. For a man taking his new job, the swing shift at McDonald's, very seriously. That wasn't funny enough, was it? I should have gone for something serious to start with, and then you people would have laughed. I keep forgetting how twisted you are. A priest, a rabbi, I guess to some of you by now, a holy person, a TV evangelist, somebody who announces what they do for a living. They're being interviewed, or you meet them. And you can see the seriousness. You can feel it. That what I do is serious business. It's my full-time job. I chose it. I love it. It's meaningful. It's a heavy weight on me. Yes, indeed. But I've been called to do it. And those not similarly engaged, there's a part of life's body that fairly freely people will pop up and go, Jesus. They'll make fun of it and they'll say, you're nuts. What's serious about it? It's open as a joke. The people involved, including you, and it might be now a plumber, a bricklayer, working as a computer driver of some kind, do you see that generally speaking, out there in the marketplace, out in the city, there is a kind of built-in seriousness to the public voice? Or you couldn't hold on to it. Now, there is, we could say, little shady areas wherein many people, many, many people I know will bellyache about their job. But there is a sense in which a person cannot let what seems to be their private voice, try to listen to me twice as fast because I'm talking about two things simultaneously, that their private voice, they can't let it enter into the public voice. They can't let their hobby attitude come into the job attitude. Imagine this. Imagine, how about a little singer, somebody gives him a song and he records a song and it's a real heartbreak thing about how he married his childhood sweetheart and they had a little child, and just a month after it was born, right at Christmas, the wife suddenly died and now he worries about her. And imagine this happens periodically. Some of you should know to keep up with that kind of stuff. And it's a big hit. Now, can you imagine right quick me making this up? Then he's got to hit the road, so he puts out the word and a whole bunch of musicians show up and they've heard it. You know, and they all think, knowing musician type people, and they go, you know, and he says, yeah, but the gig's paying so much a week. And they go, hey. if the guy, my fictitious guy, that had this hit, if he's wired up to be successful for at least the run of the record, 6 or 8 weeks, he won't understand what, but as soon as all musicians get together and they get a few drinks and they have a few smokes, and he, you know, points out to them, fine, maybe they start making a little laugh like, you know, I'm starting out to take this gig because that song of yours, you know. And he might go, hey, when I first heard it, I felt the same way. When I was recording it, I almost gagged. But the son of a bitch has sold $1.5 million. And remember what I'm paying you guys? And they go, yeah. And if life knew what it was doing in those conditions, listen quick now, I'm not really talking about anything out there. He wouldn't understand it, but he'd have to say something like, hey, if we're going to get through the next 6 weeks that we're booked up for, and we're going to have to play this thing at least once a night, we can't joke about it. It's going to ruin it. So just wait till the gig's over. 6 weeks from now, we'll all go our separate ways, and we'll, you know, we'll laugh about it. But you can't do that. Now, I'm stretching it to put that on a person out in life that might happen. But in a sense, that kind of thing happens. People who end up in the ministry have got to almost pull the same thing. That it begins to strike them here and there that this whole gig, assuming people in the ministry thought that way, that this whole gig is a farce. I can't go back out there on the platform. I can't go back there in the synagogue or the church and sing this song about, oh, my baby died and my heart's broken. I can't go out there and sing, do what we say, and the gods are going to, you know, pay you back later. But then it's like, instead of just a 6 or 8 week gig that's been booked up for the hit record, here's a guy who spent 8 or 10 years in school, worked his way up, and he's got his own church or whatever. And it's built into life, if he is going to continue this job, if his public voice is going to continue along that line, life makes him, again, forget, understand. He doesn't understand. But there is like a crude built-in knowledge that goes along with the job, is I can't go around continuing to laugh at this and to scoff at it. And if he thought in such a way, in such words, it would be more like, this will drive me nuts, the pressure will be too great, I just can't do it. I've either got to do one or the other, I cannot try and go in two directions. I can't laugh at my job. I can't laugh at my public voice. I can't let my private voice keep doing this to my public voice. The private voice does this, but it's like you have got to keep them separate. Now, I'm still talking about people in the city. I'm not talking about you people. There is this division. Of course, I've pointed out this division in many ways, but this is a specific one tonight, as some of you are beginning to feel. The two exist, they serve a purpose, and to varying degrees. It's according to how I was trying to get you to see from moment to moment. I can describe them, and you can feel it. You should be able to have your own examples. I'm probably going to throw out some more in the next few minutes. But in a way that they can operate in almost isolation, such as if you followed my story about the man in the ministry, the guy with the hit record, that is almost, under certain conditions, that he can go off, especially if he gets a little alcohol or some drugs in him. All of you should understand that. And almost go, ew, what a yucky song. Maybe talk to his girlfriend or his manager and say, that song makes me gag. And the manager said, me too. But boy, aren't we lucky we found it. And they go, yeah. And then even the manager may say, by the way, the new band coming in, you know, you can't start this. It doesn't make me gag, because you're going to have to, you realize in 6 weeks, you're playing here whatever number of nights that would be, nonstop. This is your one chance at stardom. You've got to grab it. You can't go out there laughing at this. You understand that, don't you? And he'd probably go, yeah. That there are little 13, 14-year-old girls paying $20, and their mothers are coming here, a bunch of adults, according to the demographics, are buying this record. And they're not laughing at it. He'd go, yeah, I know. And he's going to have to say, all right, don't get drunk. Don't make any fun. Don't even curl your lip up when you say, all right, now we're going to do my hit song. And the guy go, yeah. It's like the public voice knows, the private voice can't get up here on stage. It's like the minister knows, Jesus, what's happening when the first night that I said, if you love God, if you love the gods, you shouldn't be sick. And the woman stood up and hollered, I've been cured of migraines. And he went, oh, holy shit, this has started. And then the next night it happens. And he goes out and has a few drinks and thinks, you know, this is too weird for me. I got a guy that's business. It was pretty good, but I can't have people following me around pulling on the limo saying, heal me, heal me. But then if it keeps going, his public voice. One reason I went ahead and threw in the minister is because I know damn well that a whole lot of you down in your own private voice somewhere wonders, you know, that you've had some part, we'll assume, of you wired up, that you laughed at everybody from the Pope to faith healers. And then, though, you wondered, or you may have even discussed it with some other person, about, boy, I bet they have a great laugh at our expense. Not really. You can't keep it up, an ordinary person. Can't keep it up. I might point out to you, anybody who, this was not the point, I'm getting to somewhere close to that, but how common it is, if you don't know, for people that have to get on a stage and apparently have a public voice that is magnified, how common it is for them to take to the bottle, ministers included, faith healers, musicians, and there are several directions that I could point you to look at it, but one of them is that there has to be such a dichotomy between the public and the private voice. And since I'm there, let me point out another one that I was throwing in, I did throw in that you could look at as being the difference between almost a battlefield and one's own backyard. That there'd be things that you'd be doing in the community, that you'd be doing out in public. It would be almost a kind of struggle with other people. Whereas you want to get home, get in your own backyard, and assume you got at least a little 10-foot fence and a little barbecue, and to sit down and go, phew. But where I was the third one I threw in was not dissimilar to an actor with a script. And then, as opposed to someone if I can quote myself, someone on their bloody own. Think about how great it is to have a script. Think about the number of you people. Since we started these public programs, I've let you people take over. How about the number of you that I'm sure has not been up on a stage since high school, if ever, or never been on a stage without almost fainting, and now you've done it here. But look at the difference in somebody. If you were somewhere at a Rotary Club or somewhere, and somebody says, hey, would you get up and say a few words? Our speaker didn't get here, and you're in business, and we're a bunch of businessmen. Get up and tell us something about your new business. You can't swallow, and your heart pounds. The difference between that and you finally, there's a script. They say, somebody here says, well, play such and such part. And you, I said, come on, it's just a short part. But you get the part, there it is, the words. You practice a while, they change the words a little bit, it gets down. Maybe even you say, well, I think it'd sound better, be easier for me to say if you'd change this line here just a little bit, the words, the way the sentence is. Anyway, finally, it's like it's not you. It takes a load off people. It is not like being on your bloody own for somebody to say, all right, I'm going to quit tonight, and you come up here and talk a while about what this has meant to you. Yes, the difference between that and if I gave you a script beforehand, or here's what I want you to do. Memorize it. Go ahead and bring the notes, but at least have it memorized enough that you just barely got a glance down. You can get up there and apparently, extemporaneously, talk for about 30 minutes about what this has meant to you. Now, that's a different story. All you got to do is go exactly by that script. All right, all of you should understand that. Now, you do know, as always, that we're not talking simply about actors and scripts. You do understand by now, or some of you at least strongly suspect that I'm correct, that life has given people in the city a script. Now, there seems to be temporary time out. There seems to be temporary destabilizations along the way that I'm not sure what to do, but by and large, you know what to do. Think about it. You're 30, 40, 50 years old? Has there been some period, like for 10 years, I couldn't decide what to do, and I sat in my bathroom? I had to take off 7 years one time because my plant closed down, and I thought, hell, that's the only job I've ever done. What'll I do now? And I sit down at the kitchen table, and it took, well, of course, it wasn't 7 years. I just said that. It was 6 years, 9 months, and 47 days because my wife kept track. And she finally shook me, and she says, I think my brother will give you a job over at his Buick dealership. And I went, oh, good, and I got up. You have known what to do. Now, part of you, the difference between the kind of voices of part of you is continually bellyaching about it, perhaps, but you know exactly what to do. It can bellyache about, I don't get up in the morning, but it knows exactly what to do, that you've got to get up. You've got to get up or you cannot pay the mortgage. You've got to get up. Life has given everybody a script except those who voluntarily, willfully engage in this. And life still tries to put a script on you. Life still tries to tell you what I'm talking about. You leave here, and it's like life's own private voice tries to talk to your private voice and says, some of that's pretty interesting, I guess. But it's no more than if you really boiled it down and put a collar on him, he's really talking about just being a good Christian, being a good Jew. That's all it is. Don't get carried away by that. All the way from that to, this has been pretty interesting so far, but you could spend your time better than this. It's not going anywhere. Life has a script, and the part that is scripted for you, the part that there is, other than the, as I've already pointed out, and I may touch on another way tonight, a kind of temporary destabilization in the ordinary dominant submissive dynamic that people just suddenly feel temporarily that I'm not sure what to do. Notice that has not, is why you laughed, me exaggerating about this 7 or 10 years gone. These little moments do not, over a long survey of your life, they have not had any impact. Face it, I didn't say not much impact, just none. If you just try to look at it from an ordinary 3D, ordinary view, what have the little times of my life? Like, it took me, I kept wanting to leave my first wife or my first husband. And tell you the truth, I thought about it about 2 years after we were married, and then we took another. In other words, I stayed with him or her for almost 2 years contemplating it. Now, you could say, all right, that was almost 2 years I didn't know what to do. You're wrong. One of the voices would tell you, no, we should leave. But it wasn't like 2 years you were immobile. You were not put into some kind of suspended animation. It just seemed to be 2 years that there was a continuing dialogue, a temporary destabilization that was just going on momentarily. But it did not immobilize you. There has been no temporary destabilization, no temporary indecision. Even if the temporary indecision seemed to span a matter of years, it has not had an impact on your life. You cannot look back now, even if you were just reasonably sane, if you were just almost a friend. There's no way you can look back and say, that's wrong. It's as almost as though you have had a script. Not that you still don't have some voices that say, well, I don't like it. Be that as it may. You try to ask somebody, what are you going to do next? What are you going to say next? When did you plan to be like you are? And if they could be a friend, if they could be a fictitious, reasonably insane person just for a second, the answer everywhere, in all cities everywhere, the answer is, oh my God. And of course, it doesn't happen. People can't see it. But the question as to, all right, if there is no script, when did you decide in general to become what you are? There is no answer. Do I have to take it any further? How about into specifics? When did you decide to be such a prick? Pardon my language. When did you decide to be so pushy? When did you decide to be so shy and retiring? When? When? Just tell me when. I don't care. I just want to know when. Give me a date. Of course, I'm leaving out a real dirty one is, all right, 1942, okay? Why? We won't be that dirty. Even I draw the line at some cheap shots. Can any of you see a connection between, I'll give you an easy one, between the public and the private voices and the partnership? One of the great areas that if we're not trying to, it's not part of what this is, but if, surely by now you understand why I'm going to bring this kind of thing up for an example. If me or someone that had some understanding of this tried to present this out in the public, more or less as I've been talking to you people, to large numbers of people, one of the areas that is just absolutely blind to 3D consciousness is that life is as diverse and as complex as you are. Life is internally as antagonistic to itself as you are. That's what ordinary consciousness is blind to. That is that life over here can be talking about humanity should be going in such and such direction. We should all love one another and look after one another. That one's been around as long as man's been able to write and remember. Then, there's constantly other areas of life's body that seems to be a living anathema to that. But ordinary 3D consciousness looks at it as being anomalies. They look at it ordinarily as being living manifestations of evil, that something is amiss. Nothing is amiss in you. There are parts of you that have these great ideals, and you dream great dreams, and you dream of helping your fellow man, and being charitable, being good-natured, being tolerant to the breaking point. And there are parts of you that make Mussolini look like a pussycat. It's a fact. And if you say it ain't a fact, you don't know hardly nothing. That's philosophical talk for you people out of town. Ordinary 3D consciousness cannot get a picture of the total complexity that life can be in one area, talking and apparently doing a certain thing in another area to a degree that almost seems to be in direct conflict, doing almost that which is diametrically opposed. And that both of them are serving a purpose, and that there is not an aneurysm on life's brain in one part as opposed to over here. 3D consciousness cannot deal with that. That would be, to put in other terms, that would be as though ordinary people were suddenly made to see the fact that, hey, what you call good and evil is like up and down. It's like right and left. Like black and white. Green and yellow. It's like having two eyes. That they're both just kind of the same thing. Just interchangeable, it doesn't matter. Now, you know that is not, life has not arranged itself to where that is going to fly in the city. If you made any progress, and as you people out in the city, if you made any progress in the last 4,000 years, I would say, I'd propose to you that it could be measured in inches along those particular lines. But you could look upon life's general voice in any given area. We'd have to talk about the area of life's body, of the planet. Some time frame, some specific area. Middle Europe in the Middle Ages. The Roman Empire in the later days in the 400s. The Middle East, 2200 B.C. And then you'd have to pick out a specific area, and then whatever history said, or contemporaneously. Right now, something going on, what you would be looking at. If they said, all right, the voice, even though they're splintered and in many parties right now, if it seemed to be, let us say, your community's attitude toward the Italians' political attitude right now, if there was such, what you would be getting if it did exist, I'm sorry I started this, looking at your faces and looking at your people's face on tape at some other time, I can already tell. It would be, if there was such a thing as America's attitude, including you, not just politically, but you just felt caught up into it, just from reading 5 minutes, that you suddenly felt caught up in a part of this that was pointing out some American writer, pointing out what seems to be the consensus of the Italian attitude toward NATO, let's put it that way. And you went, yeah, and it seemed to mean something to you. In a sense, what you're dealing with then is life has taken the public voices of all the little Italians and combined them. And then it's taken the hearing of all the little Americans and combined them hearing the public voice. And that's what came out in this little article. The man may have sat down in Washington and knocked out a deadline behind him. And he knocked it out just about as fast as he could type. They run it through and you read it in about 5 minutes and threw it away. But you felt something while you were reading it. Like, that's good to know. Or, huh, boy, never could trust those Italians. Uh-huh, that makes me concerned about world peace. I wonder what's for supper. At that moment, the only reason I brought all this up is that there is a way in which life has the public voices of a group of people, a tribe, a collection of people that's identified by other people. That the Yugoslav says, those are Albanians, and those are Italians. And Italians say, there's Albanians, that sort of thing. Of course, you know that I'm not talking about geopolitical states out there. All that's true in here. But the level I was going to point out that ordinary people in the city, ordinary 3D consciousness, can never perceive this, is that this goes on continually, and there are apparently such diverse forces at work in life that ordinary consciousness says some of these forces have got to be wrong. And ordinary consciousness, of course, at any given time is only dealing with two forces. You can only look at the Italian political scene at one time and look at the splintered attempts, the apparent continual failing attempts at democracy there as opposed to the growing threat of the Communist Party there. It can only do two at once. And then it can look, all right, what if we look at Yugoslavia? I'm not going to carry it any further. Ordinary consciousness will only pick out a situation and see it, as you should know by now, in a binary sense. But then it sees that one of the possibilities, one of the apparent forces, one of the groups involved, is so wrong that it's somewhere verging from an anomaly to evil incarnate. And it cannot simply see that it's been one large segment of a people's public voice temporarily put together, and it seemed to be a large group of people, like a tribe, like a nation. Some identifiable group seems to have a consensus of opinion, a consensus of a public voice. It can be gone like that. There was a purpose of me going through all that, but I'm not going to dwell on it based upon the great success I seem to have had in the last few minutes for getting you to even go that far. So take it on your own. There was a purpose in that. Now back internally, where the most fun is for the few people. I guess if I push this far enough or change a little bit, I keep saying fun for us, I might could be some kind of political entertainer. Because ordinary people would think that I'm making fun of the popes and rabbis and Albanians. Back to the serious stuff. Back to the good stuff. Can you see that individually people, with no analyzation, humanity's idea, right at the center of humanity's idea of some other human being a hero, I can describe to you very simply. It is the unanalyzed, unexpressed belief, which I'm about to First time on this planet expressed for humanity, at least for our day and time. Right at the core of you thinking that somebody else is a hero is the unanalyzed belief that their public and private voice is merged. Merged to the point that they are inseparable, and there's really, in your hero, no longer a public and a private voice. It's one. That's the idea of heroes, from Moses to Buddha to Jesus to Pete Rose. Clint Eastwood. John Updike. Shakespeare. I'm trying to cover all the way from football players, it may seem strange, to actors. In fact, speaking of actors, a prime example connected to this, several years back I happened to pick up an article that somebody went to do with, I guess at that time, America's best known and best loved heroic actor. I don't even bother to name him, but just seemed to be the epitome of a man's man, a patriotic guy, just more than a movie star, evidently, to the American public and other parts of the world. And they started interviewing me. It wasn't a hatchet job. That wasn't the intention. But it was in his later days, he died, if I recall, not too long after that. But at any rate, they pointed out that they were sitting down, they gave the background, the interviewer did, and that guy had a bar there and began to have a few drinks. It was there as a real piece of puff. It was obvious. They started talking, and evidently, either the interviewer or the editor or whatever the publication was just couldn't let it go. And he pointed out the man began to have a few drinks, and they talked a while about his movies and how he felt about this and that and politics. And it came out, just I read an article for fairly short with the interview, the man began to express... I'll put it to you this way. By the time he evidently had two or three drinks, the kinds of things he began to tell this interviewer would give prejudice and xenophobia a good name. He ended up insulting almost every race, creed, nationality. But I don't mean in some backhanded way. It's began to come out that, yes, and he had named some group of people. There's no doubt. They started World War I. They're trying to take over the world. And, of course, now they've got this other group in cahoots with them. Just this kind of citywide, insane idea of collusion and evil being afoot. And, I mean, he picked out all the best known, the better known nations, races, and religions, and had a very specific, direct, and to him, obviously, serious insult about these goddamn people. And it just came out. That is an absolute blow to the heart, to the idea of a hero. Another little part that I found interesting that you should, trust me, I never heard that mentioned. It was in a national publication. I wouldn't have picked it up by accident. Never mentioned. Never heard anybody refer to, oh my God! It was like it never happened. It was like finding out that, you know, Jesus slept around or used to dress up in women's clothing at night. It's like it reaches a certain point and the city will not deal with it on that basis. Go back to where I started before the example. Evidently, all of you heard it, or enough of you heard it enough, that the idea that's never been analyzed, but whoever you thought, whoever you had as a hero, I'm not going to ask you, of course, and you don't have to defend it, but all of you had heroes. Your public voice has still got them. And some of you have got into your private voice, which is another matter. But everybody's wired up to have heroes. And your idea, you can't imagine a Moses or a Jesus or a Bertrand Russell or whoever. Or Clint Eastwood. You can't imagine him. You just can't. As being anything other than your perception of him. Or he would not be a hero. It's that simple. If somebody tried to say, well, wait a minute, you know, I bet you sometimes Eastwood or Sir John Salty. He gets off the bandstand, he says, if I ever hear Beethoven again, I'm going to blow my brains out. And then gets drunk and kicks his wife around. If I told you that, if I told you I read that, you might go, well, wait a minute. And right, somewhere in your wiring system, the noise that passes for yellow circuit activity might run through like, well, maybe one time Sir John did get drunk, or Pete Rose did beat his wife, or got drunk and threw up out in an elevator. But it's just like, well, never mind that. That is not... It's like it doesn't exist. That there is no private voice. There is no private side to my hero. Or he would not be a hero. Or she would not. that what my conception is of a Moses or a Buddha, they did not go off in private and act some other way. They did not go off in private and Buddha call all the guys around. Said, can you believe the people following me around buying this shit? Does not happen. You can't imagine Pete Rose going in, having a few drinks and hollering. Can you believe people come out here day after day to see us knock this little funny ball around and pay whatever it is, $10 a shot? Ha! Give me another beer. Talk about a bunch of rubes. As I've started out some of this to point out, they can't really do that and stay on that job. You could not believe that that would be true. It just cannot even sink into consciousness at the ordinary level. And those people be heroic. Now, can anybody see any possible significance? Are any of you already afraid that I'm about to say this? Can you see the need? Can you see the need and the possibility in the way to be a hero to yourself? Because I can tell you directly, which I've done once before, but I'll tell you directly, none of you have any business, don't ever let any ordinary human be your hero. Now, it's already wired up. All of you is already. It's too late. But I'm telling the part of you now that would be revolutionary. Don't let anybody be your hero. It's as bad, it's as dangerous, it's entertaining seriously hostility. Of actually becoming any anger you might feel. Any idea that this person is heroic and I want to feel heroic toward him. Almost worshipful. It's as dangerous as anything else you could do. You should certainly never, ever, if you need one further hint, you should never be impressed by anybody who obviously wants you to be. Anybody in any way wants you to be impressed, and you can tell, all you got to be is halfway sober and out of the sun. Anybody who wants you to be impressed with them, don't be. Trust me. And it's just obvious that, no doubt, they want me to be impressed by them. Don't. That was just an additional hint. It's covered by saying you got no business allowing yourself to take anybody as a hero. And there's a lot to that. There's a lot to what I've already covered about the belief if they're a hero somewhere, this kind of dichotomy has been merged. Their job is their hobby. Their hobby is their job. Their backyard, their private life is their public battlefield. What they're doing is what they're doing. What I see they're doing, what I perceive they're doing, what I believe they're doing is all they do. I think I made enough little examples and brought out enough that in a certain sense, all you've got to do is use the good old higher circuits just somewhere close to the purpose that they, or at least the ability they have, and you know that's not true. How can you believe that an actor with a script, I'm talking about a real actor now, not you, a guy paid to be it, that he's that way all the time? Or that James Brown, as much as I love the man, that there he is smiling and hanging, get down, and good God, that that's all there is to him? He just got through again putting bullets in his wife's car, which is not the first time. I was bringing this out, really, the basis of showbiz. When you know, like an actor, that just the ordinary runnings of your yellow circuit should tell you that there is no reason I should believe that Clint Eastwood or John Wayne is that way all the time. But notice, if any of those people, or anybody else you can think of, or Katharine Hepburn, somebody struck me, what a person, if I could just meet them, which is another story indeed. Notice how many people, how few people actually will expend the effort that they will sit around and say that they would to meet a hero. Would you believe that life somewhere knows that, you know, it can only push itself so far? Well, if we were city people and I was psychologically inclined, I could say that subconsciously people, many people know I'm probably better off not ever getting around and having a few drinks with Pete Rose or Billy Martin or Clint Eastwood. It might ruin it. That's not the basis of it, but I said if we were ordinary people talking psychologically, I could put it to you that way. Now back to you. Much more fun than Clint Eastwood, and obviously more literate than Katharine Hepburn, I think most of you are, is your own hero. What is it? What is it you would find heroic? What is it you would find admirable in you? I'll tell you. If there was some part of you that did not seem to have a public and a private voice, if there was some part of you that you could depend on, if there was some part of you that could, if it wanted to, or had, or for some reason had a few drinks, would not suddenly start talking in such a way that you won't grab me and say, phew, don't talk that way in front of me. Don't tell me stuff like that. I thought I was better than that. So who has heroes? Why is it that people look externally? Everybody. It is not psychological. It is not cultural. It's not sexual. Everybody on this planet has been wired up that somebody's your hero. It might have been your father. It could have been your mother. But you notice in our day and time, since we have the fast and almost instantaneous, during this century, communication of information, it seems very likely that people have heroes outside the family, all the way from actors to showbiz, singers, politicians, people who've been dead thousands of years. But the whole idea of the hero, as I told you, is the unanalyzed, unproven, but the belief that they have no public and private voice. Internally, they are one voice. That is a hero. And if it was proven, if it was your consciousness was made to see otherwise, they would just ruin it. That hero would no longer be a hero. Now, my several rhetorical questions to wrap up this paragraph, if you remember, is what would be an internal hero? Why is it that everyone is wired up to have an external hero? Why is no one their own hero? Rather than the obvious in the city, everybody says, well, I'm no good. So why is it you think that Clint Eastwood is so good? Why is it you think the Pope has got to be just what he appears and what you imagine he is? Especially dead people were exactly like you imagined they were. Not only you, but large numbers of people. It's not just your attitude that Moses had to be a... God, what a guy. And around him privately, he'd been just like we heard he is publicly. You're not by yourself. Millions of people, if they heard it expressed that way, would join right in and go, yes, no doubt. They just don't make them like him anymore. I still want to say another little something, since I didn't lay on it much, about the dichotomy of me splitting up into job and a hobby. In a sense, you've got to be paid to do everything in this column. You got to be paid to do it as opposed to actually doing it. It's my hobby. I'm doing it because I want to. I'm doing it because it's close to me, my own backyard. I'm doing it, this is getting down to, of course, the revolutionary sense, I'm doing it because this is, seems to be the one area that there is no goddamn script. It seems to be the one area that I have at least a modicum, or at least apparently the possibility of some movement, that I might be able to suddenly ad-lib a line or so. Right here on the stage, and everybody else is locked into it. Every now and then, it's almost as though I can do a little piece of business and get by with it. They don't fire me. They don't throw me off the stage. The other actors don't attack me. Everything in the left-hand column, in a sense, there's a reason for this, so I wouldn't repeat it for the upcoming third time. In a sense, you've got to be paid to do it. But a large part of the ordinary life is spent in that left column, to say the least. And I don't mean just the hours spent on your literal job. You've got to know I don't mean just that. It is reflective. It is parallel to that. But everything that takes place that I could fit into that left column, if you can begin to see it for yourself, in a sense, you've got to be paid to do it. And yet, in a sense, you take it very seriously. And the public voice will say, it will even say, well, I would do this for nothing if I had to. This is my life. Show business is my life. Religion is my life. Electrical wiring is my life. Is it? How about this? Being me is my life. If you weren't paid, would you be you? If you weren't paid to do it? You're going to have to go off on your own and expand it, I guess, enough, since I'm not going to for you. But I said that by a general definition of what I mean, in a sense, you've got to be paid, and you are being paid to be you. If you weren't paid to do it, would you do it? Would you go if your job was cleaning out septic tanks? You mean you'd go out and do it on the weekend? You'd check with your friends and neighbors, like, does anybody need you? I'm free most of the day. Saturday in hell, I get itchy when I'm not around a septic tank. Could I come clean yours out? Would you be you if you were not paid to? If it was not scripted? If it was not the public voice, and you're for the world in general, along your genetic line, and then you in public, that seems to be you. It seems to be the face you present. It's the face that if you are suddenly stopped and forced to analyze it in some way, it's what you believe you are. It's how you at least think your friends or an impartial observer would describe you. That's your public voice. But I'm telling you, if you weren't paid to do it, you wouldn't be doing it. Can any of you see? Well, I guess it's for the benefit of you people in other times and other places getting this. I was going to say that I waste, surely, several seconds every night of saying, I'm going to drag in something from last time, which, if you were here and listening, I don't have to say that. But if you people out of town are getting this for the first or second time on tape, in case you wonder why I keep saying it, I'm wasting those few seconds. Of course, now I just wasted even more seconds trying to tell you why I do it. A few of the things from the last few meetings related here, too, to the public and private voice. I ask you if you could see a connection between that and the partnership. Now, a lot of you have been finding, over the last few weeks, interest in me pointing out the time lag between the lower circuits and the upper circuits, and how the upper circuits cannot stick to an apparent decision, stick to an apparent analyzation of some experience, stick to an apparent plan long enough, which is going to take generally at least 24 hours, for the lower circuits to catch up, and even if there's any chance of them agreeing, it's going to take at least 24 hours for them to get to the point to understand that this is serious. This is going to have an effect. All right, this time lag. Can any of you see, in another sense, a connection between that, and remember my drawings of the circuits, dividing them up into the upper and the lower. Can any of you see the time lag being between the lower and the upper circuits? And then the sense of the partnership that I have at times referred to as Smith and Jones, you know, like the partnership, and according to what kind of information, what kind of requests, what kind of demands are coming into the business as to whether the whoever answers the phone admits that they're Smith or Jones. It's like, well, what do you want? Can any of you see a connection between the public, the private voices, the upper and the lower circuitry, and the time lag, specifically it being the older lower circuits being Smith and the younger vocal ones being Jones, and that there is a time lag that is inherent, that the phone cannot be shifted. One cannot go immediately in the ordinary conditions of the city from one's public voice to one's private voice. You cannot suddenly go from, oh, you want to collect money? Well, this is Smith on the phone. Who you need is Jones, my partner, and he's out of town. An ordinary person cannot suddenly jump into the other one. That is, oh, you're trying to collect money. Well, I'm Smith, and Jones is out of town. You'll have to call him and take care of all the bills. And you start to hang up, and the other person, remember, metaphorically, please, quick. And the other person says, no, I'm sorry, you had it wrong. I didn't say that you owed us money. I owe you money. We won't send it over. You cannot suddenly go, oh, well, I'm Smith after all. I'm Jones after all. Sorry. Forget literally. You cannot do that. People are not wired up to do that. It is detrimental to your general health if you try it, if you're an ordinary person. It would be detrimental for the man. Going to sing this song about my little baby died on Christmas, just after giving birth to our little son. To be backstage and laughing and going, ugh, the other guys about, what a yucky song. And then they say, all right, let's bring him back for an encore to do his big hit, My Little Wife Died at Christmas. And he comes back on and tries to. If that did, I'm not saying that never happens in life. If that does happen, I assure you later, that guy has to get very, very drunk. He probably had to get drunk to come out there and do the song after that. The kind of people who come out, and it, like I said, that many people, I'm sure, imagine that these ministers laugh at what they're pulling off. Somewhere, I'm sure some of them have done it. But if they do, they pay a horrendous price for it, just in ordinary sense. You cannot take the two voices and jump from one to the other immediately. The ordinary person cannot commingle them, which is the same thing. It would create, I think some of you already heard it, Ordinary terminology would be things such as totally unacceptable psychological pressure, stress. But I'm saying it's taking the wiring system, it's taking energies that run in certain directions, feeding different parts of your circuitry, and trying to suddenly grab wires and run together. It is not dissimilar, those of you who went through the excursion of me pointing out, to give somebody the kind of attitude they put out to you, reversing the flow and what it does to people. It just stops them. To do that internally to yourself, if you're an ordinary person, would be extremely unprofitable, if you're an ordinary person. Now back to the revolutionary person, you got no choice. You got to see where the two voices are. You got to be able to hear that there's like an older, slower moving, almost nonverbal Jones or Smith, and there's a younger, more vocal Jones. You got to see that there are two voices that have been going on all your life. You got to see that they go on in everyone else. You got to see that everyone else, including you at line level consciousness, seems to be operating from some script. I know it seems vague, and I'm not going to sit here and debate it. I don't have to prove it. I couldn't prove it. Not trying to prove it. But you should now be able to feel that up until now, as strange as it would have been had I previously tried to analyze this or discuss it, as strange as it would look or would have seemed at that time, there is no doubt there's some kind of damn script going on. Or else how have I made it this far? Because if you can turn that question on yourself, or imagine me there asking you, what are you going to say next? When did you decide to be like you are? There is no answer. Ordinary consciousness cannot even deal with the question. It's like trying to put a rhinoceros in your hot water bag. There's nowhere to go with it. Consciousness will just shut off. Since I was pointing out the strange ways that life, or the ways that life has some information available, and ordinary consciousness can't see it, I thought of one. This ought to be tenuous enough to test the mettle of the best of you. Can any of you see a connection between the apparent rise of the so-called third world and Americans jogging? Well, everybody's familiar now with the third world. I guess that phrase makes the papers as much as, or more so nowadays, than running dog capitalists, unfair trade advantages. Third world countries, third world attitudes, but the third world countries, especially in our lifetime, but like the last 10 years, it's almost as though, whatever they mean by the third world countries, it's almost as though they just discovered them. They're now fad. Surely you know what I'm saying. They're everywhere. The third world countries, the third world peoples, they are right now fad. Do you not see any connection between that and non-third world countries? Let's say especially the Western world, not just America, Europe, the Western forces. A connection between the rise in popularity and apparent interest and apparent significance of third world countries and you jogging. No? For 2 cents, I just go on and leave it. The circuits, in a sense, I bring this up for a reason. I just picked out, it just hit me what a great example this is, and I figured it would stretch the crudity of most of you. That's why I was bringing out a little bit, that surely there are a few wirings systems here, or maybe on tape at other time, another place, wonder, how in the world is he going to get out of this? How's he going to make any sense out of it? Nay, nay. The connection. One, there's always more than one in last body, but a easily spotted connection. As soon as I point it out, you're all going to go, well, some of you will go, or maybe a few of you will go. I know I'm not going to go again. The connection between third world countries, the rise in popularity and apparent importance and significance thereof, in the Western world, people jogging. It's almost as though this. Higher circuits have almost temporarily outstripped too far the lower ones. And the lower ones are crying, wait a minute, let us catch up. I sure would like to leave it there, but not enough of you are getting anything. Do you see, let's assume, speaking to you, that I use you as archetypical. You are fairly educated, that most of you in this circa 1988, to some degree, you could, if you tried real hard, fit into being a yuppie. Then after you begin to, you got into your good job, it seemed to be, to some degree, or you thought would be intellectually challenging, computer field, electronics, medicine. And then all the yuppies, not just you, but everybody then suddenly becomes health conscious. Everybody's going to gyms, and et cetera. The very people that even 20 years or even 10 years ago, at the high school level, during that age, would have been called almost irreversible nerds. They never were out for the football team. And now these same people got a little cash, seem to have a good set of life, maybe opera tickets, tickets to the ball games also, but then start actively trying to get involved with some kind of sporting activity. You don't see any connection between the rise in popularity and apparent significance of third world countries in the Western world, you, America, taking up jogging. That your own lower circuits, you individually, large groups of people, life itself, it's almost as though the lower circuits saying, hey, you know, I can understand progress and getting ahead, but you almost got too far ahead. How about slow down and let me catch back up? Some more things from the last few meetings. You recall even last meeting I was pointing out that you could look upon man, an individual estate, and his attempted expansion, his attempted growth, change, that he could be looked upon as like a territorial government trying to expand itself, and that two things, two areas of expertise that I was suggesting would be required would be like a scout to go out and get information, the actual doer, and then to bring it back, and an analyst. Under ordinary conditions, can any of you see? You thought you saw something from last meeting. But can you see that under ordinary conditions, a person's analyst seems to be doing a very questionable thing? And that thing is this. It seems to be involved, seems to be determined to study and to analyze only outdated information. Yeah. It would be as though, to use my example from last time, that the scout goes out from the fort in the American West and he comes back with information. They got the little analyst here, the trained analyst from just came in from West Point. The scout comes back with information. He gives them just the facts, and then the analyst would sit down and say, well, let's see. And then he would begin to go about the business this way. All right, wasn't it only 8 months ago that the Sioux or the Cherokees were actually, and he would start that, that apparently all of his business of analyzing would only be done, no matter what they told him, no matter he'd apparently sit there and listen to some of it, that the scout would say, well, here's what happened. The general says, is this up-to-date information? The scout go, why do you think I'm panning? I rode here as fast as I could. The Sioux are up there on the left. And the Cheyennes we hear are coming up from Arizona, and they'll be over here within the next 2 hours. And the analyst says, huh. So let's see. 6 months ago, we heard the Cheyennes were actually over in the New Mexico territory. And if the analyst seems determined that that's the only kind of information it's going to deal with. Outdated information. Oh, well, all right. I guess what you people call the past. But that's it. Does anybody find that curious? Or is anybody going to tell me it's not true? What does the analyst deal with? If the information is too fresh and you try to push it, it's almost as though the analyst will go, hey, you know, if you're going to bug me, you just do it yourself. It will. Under ordinary conditions, the routine analyst in everybody if it's really pushed, will almost just shut down. That is what you apparently were trying to analyze, what you were apparently trying to think about. Now, many of you should hear this as I say it. It's like times that you think this is a serious problem, you're really thinking and thinking and thinking, and suddenly it's just like... And if I suddenly jumped out from behind a curtain and said, I realize you just quit thinking about that thing, why? And you were forced to say something, you would be inclined to say something like, I'm not sure, I guess I got tired. I don't know, it just seemed to be a dead end. I don't know, it just seemed to be so much indecision on what to do, and it's like I quit thinking. The analyst in people, if it is pushed far enough, if something seems to be happening to try and drag you right up to the ungodly edge of the potentially significant, which would be somewhere just a second, at least ahead of right now. Well, all right, you people would call it the present. If it's pushed far enough, what does it do in you? It will just shut down. It will fall into an even less conscious state. It will fall into an almost standing up, eyes open, dream state, reminiscing. But it's like the information brought to it, if it's too up to date, the analyst won't deal with it. It's like it is wired up and determined that, you know, the information has got to be outdated, or I'm not going to analyze it. Don't bother me with it. Now, of course, certainly no one, quote, thinks about it in that way. But the reality of it, the experience of it is what? Admit it. Well, he said it. It's just as I described it. Information is there. You've been doing it all your life. Everyone does it. What greater lesson can be learned than from experience? And if you had the lower circuits in such a way that they could talk under many conditions, they'd want to go, all right, experience is fine, but we're faced with something right now. I'm saying right now, it's outside the gate. It'll be here in an hour, 30 minutes. And the analyst goes, this reminds me of the time when I was back in school. That doesn't sound familiar. Why are you laughing? It wasn't funny. It wasn't a joke. Write it down, show it to somebody, and go, hi, you don't see a joke? That's not funny. A couple of more things. A few meetings back, I mentioned something about advertising that seemed to have bypassed most of you at that time, but I was pointing out that certain parts of life's body find certain kinds of advertising in particular to be unfitting, inappropriate, even yucky. And the example I used that night still didn't seem to strike too many of you, but there is a reality behind this, and I'm not talking about advertising, I'm not talking about a criticism of advertising, you know all that by now, you're supposed to. If you don't, cut off the tape and go home. But there is a certain kind of advertising that all you've got to do is listen, because you've got a piece of ear of the nervous system of humanity. There's certain kinds of advertising, not just a general condemnation of advertising, but certain kinds that they're talking about, they're pushing about how that XYZ muffler company, a franchise all across the country, about that the difference, mufflers are mufflers. You can get a good muffler over at Sears, you can get one at Kmart. So what's the difference? Why should you buy a muffler? It's the service. It's the XYZ muffler attitude. All right? Well, they can spend millions of dollars just on the radio. You're not seeing anything. Let's imagine this on the radio. Pushing the whole thing about the attitude, the XYZ muffler attitude. That's the whole reason. The prices are comparable, but it's the service, not just the goods, the service. Now, if you were just walking around, fairly lucid, frim, reasonably fictitious and sane person looking, just using the yellow circuits, the higher circuits, as best you could in a city sense, you know that that's nothing but advertising, because let's say that you're sophisticated enough to know that XYZ company is franchised. And if it wasn't, there's no such thing as even a Sears attitude. You just know it's impossible. They may have a book. Everybody goes to work for XYZ Muffler Company. You should dress. You should wear this little thing, this little plastic bow tie. You should tell everybody that comes in, good morning. And then they might even try. This is hard for even me to imagine. They might even try to list, to detail, to verbalize an XYZ corporate profile of how you should be. Let's assume they try to.
If you just got walking around New Jersey or Alabama since, you know the kind of money that they're paying at XYZ or Burger Doodle or McDonald's, the kind of money they're paying, there is no XYZ corporate attitude. Even if they were paying bigger money, you do know it's almost impossible. Do you follow me? It sounds nice that that's the reason to go to XYZ. They make it into even a positive thing that they're all across the country, no matter where you are. If your muffler gives out, God forbid, but if your muffler were to go, you don't have to worry about going into a strange place because there's an XYZ in almost every major city, and it's not only a good muffler and a good value you're going to get, but you're going to get the XYZ attitude. And you know that that, just to put it in the advertising sense, I think I know a little of your jargon, is that's just fucking insanity. There is no such thing. And yet if you listen, and they do it with insurance. They do all kinds of stuff that you know it's not true, but it sounds good. You should be sophisticated enough and your own nervous system will feel that if you're sitting around being paid to do that, that's the kind of thing that you got to, in some ways, admire it. As bad a rap as people have involved with car mechanics, such as muffler people, or insurance. Many people, you know, an insurance man, they'd rather die and go to hell with Stalin and live there forever than to have to talk to an insurance salesman. And yet, you can just sit there and it comes on your radio and it says, a letter from a satisfied all-state or multi-state insurance person, and they talk a policyholder. Their house burnt down and they lost all their belongings, plus one of their children, I forget which one, died in the fire. And they couldn't believe it that their local agent, if they'd only met once, was over there within 2 hours, Miss So-and-so, they name her, and she said, no problem, and within 37 hours, I had a check. And they attribute it all to that good person, Miss So-and-so, who is my agent out here in Short Circuit, Nebraska. And if you know anything, you know that that's a goddamn lie. Those agents got nothing to do with what's going on. They got nothing to do with whether you're going to get paid a claim, and they got especially nothing to do with how fast Allstate ever gives you a check. Nothing, nothing, nothing. It's not an attack on the insurance company, but if you've been around the block, you've got to know that that is not true. And yet you listen, and it almost makes you want to pull over and find an insurance office for that company. And if not by a policy, go into them and hug them and say, well, God bless you for your good word. All right. That was what many of you seem to miss, and you do know I'm not talking about absolutely really out there. I'm about to get into the parallel important reality. The upper circuits, one of your voices, is like a mad, powerful advertising agency, and it does this to you constantly. It's like one of your voices is sending out these great, it's almost a heroic epic that it sings within 30 seconds, 60 seconds of a radio ad about why you not only need and should love insurance, but this particular one. It's one of your voices singing, and the other voices is like all the possible boob consumers in the world sitting next to their radio listening to it going, yeah, yeah. Right, see if you can listen right quick. The unfitting part, the part I'm trying to get you to see, it's almost this. I've already almost put in words, but let me be a little more specific. What I'm saying is this particular kind of unfitting, almost unseemly advertising, it's like the advertising is simply too far removed from the reality of the actual goods or services. That's it. That almost one of your voices can admire. What a job. If I was in advertising, they said, hey, you got to make people love insurance agents. Or the church, or the IRS. You go, God, I admire what they've done. And another part, you should say, it's absolute bullshit. But God, what else could you do to try and make somebody want to hug an insurance agent? All right. It's as though the advertising is too far removed from the reality of the goods or the services involved. Can you see, not to take it personally, that there's a way in which you can look upon your internal advertising? You can look at it as being an also a form of planning of the analyst in you And what it comes up with continues to stay too far removed from reality. And in one particular sense, as I was just leading you up to in the prior little paragraph, it is too far removed in time. That is what strikes some people and other people. Now, not businesses, not advertising, but that seems unfitting, unseemly, almost yucky in some people, that what they talk about themselves, their advertising, is completely removed from what their goods and services seems to be. Back to your terminology. What they talk about themselves being, you simply look at as being a fairly impartial observer, that you ain't nothing like that. And yet they seem determined to hold up their head and they go through life saying, I'll tell you the kind of guy I am. I'll tell you why you should love your insurance agent. I'll tell you why you're always going to get XYZ muffler service in any XYZ muffler shop, and you know it's not true. Now, internally to you, again, can you see that that kind of analyst, that kind of Madison Avenue hack in you, that one voice that continues to plan, that continues to analyze, that continues to say you on why things should be as they are, or even why you should change, that it is always, once you begin to smell it, it is always unfitting, it is unseemly, it is useless, because it is too far removed from the reality of whatever your goods and services are. That is what you are. It is always too far removed. And in the planning and the analysis stage of that kind of advertising, what I was trying to get you to see that hardly anyone reacted is it's too far removed in time. The analyst is sitting there again about, wait a minute. This does seem to be a sticky problem, how to sell the people, the rest of me, on this plan. And there seems to be some immediate information that might be used. Wait a minute. Now, you know what this reminds me of? It either happened to me 10 years ago or I read about it happened to somebody else. And that seems to be the basis of planning the advertising campaign. That seems to be the basis of analyzing what is going on. As far as it being too far removed in time, how about the 24-hour lag? How about the 3-minute dynamic that I mentioned one time? And how about the ever-popular, always-present 1 second you've got before that, which comes in as energy in the system, permeates the system. That you've got 1 second at the most for the talking noise in you to say to someone, well, fuck you, you've got less than a second not to do that. It's already there, but you got a time lag of a second, which is meaningless out in the ordinary world. You might as well not exist. But that's what you got. Some more wrap-ups. Last time, you recall I was pointing out that how there seems to be an inbred interest, fascination of the film studios making movies about making movies, and then I point out that a real revolutionist, in a sense, is living a life about making a life. A little addendum to what I'd already said. The thing about the revolutionist living a life about making a life, the parallel between that and making a movie about making a movie, has a piece thusly that while everyone else is taking their life, taking the movie of their life as being serious and probably inevitable, to the real revolutionist, this whole thing of the seriousness and the possibly inevitability of it, to him it's like, hey, it's just film stock. It's not like it had a plot. It's film stock. It's not a movie yet, not in my case. It's not a story. It has no beginning and end. It's film stock. What's there to get serious about? And evidently, there's plenty, I say plenty, is going to be enough to last you up until you cash in. If there's some book somewhere and you're listed as going to live to be 81 years old, the stock is not going to run out. You're not going to run out of film before you get there. Thanks a lot. I thought it might help some of you to bring it back up. It's just film stock. That once you get freed from the belief that I am in a movie that is serious, and especially one of the voices, one of the partnership, always being driven to pop up and say, well, we do have a hand in writing this. But the general feeling of the seriousness and the possible inevitability of all this, which of course makes it serious. If you can then shift it to where there is a beginning, a burgeoning reality to the fact that you are no longer simply now making a movie, living a life. What you're actually doing is you're living a life now about living a life. That the whole point of my life is living it to make, like I'm going to make a life. It's a movie about making a movie. If that becomes in any way real, then you'll know what I meant. That, hey, it's just film stock. What a tragedy has happened to you. Well, it's just film stock. I can't believe that this happened to you and that you're up still walking around and sober, not in a hospital and not insane. You wouldn't necessarily say this to people now because you are just barely beginning to laugh at it, so don't go tell other people when they say, how could you stand that your business blew up and your second wife left you again? Hey, it's just film stock. But some of you might begin to understand it. Something else from last week. This one won't take but a second, but it's a good... I might as well say this. You remember the one that I was pointing out about... I started off asking you last time we met the ever-popular musical question. Do people actually talk about things that have happened, or do they talk about what they think about things that have happened? Now, you remember that one. And I thought long enough that almost all of you got a glimpse of something, whether you were able to expand it into any other possible significance to you personally yet or not. So, the notion that I sort of left you with or made you, tried to make you see in a certain sense, that under most conditions, people are not talking about experience. They're not thinking about what happened. They're not thinking about the actual, if it didn't even happen to them. They're not even thinking about, in an analytical way, what the scout says is going on right outside the gate. It's going to be up on you. It's going to be your reality in a matter of minutes. All the way from that to actually what they thought they had seen or experienced. That, generally speaking, people do not think, people do not especially talk about it. They talk about what they think about it, right? I got you up to there. Well, I was going to point out one reason. One real reason that people like you like people like me is because I don't tell you what I think. Think about it. I guess some of you thought otherwise until I just said that. But none of you, I've never told any of you what I think. In private, drunk, sober, New York, California, here. Of course, that's assuming I think. edit that. That was a cheap shot. I shouldn't tell you people things like that because some of you might take it seriously. Some of you might take it correctly. Some of you may try to take it with you to that big bank in the sky and someday try to cash that in. And I don't want to hear what they have to say to you. I believe that I will wrap up or get close to it. Once, not too long ago, when I had, if you recall, a fictitious code of conduct for revolutionists. When I pointed out if there was such a thing, that might include, if you recall, and I had a list read of things that, if there were such a thing, of a revolutionist code of conduct that I suggested that it might include such things. And one of them was the real revolutionist never asked for mercy. I want to tell you something about that. And I'm not just saying this in general because many people here in and out of town, I got a reason for saying this. One reason that you should not ask for mercy under any conditions, is that if there is someone who could actually offer you meaningful mercy, they would already understand that you need it and what kind you need it. So other than that, to ask for mercy is even beyond a moot act. It's just not possible. Because if anybody could give you any kind of meaningful mercy, they would already know you needed it, and they would know what kind you needed it, and that'd be it. So anybody that you would have to ask for it cannot give it. I got a reason for telling you that. A whole bunch of you. All right, one more paragraph. This has been hanging around my head. Well, that's not like I think about things, though. Well, some phrases that I hear out in the city, and I've even seen them on little plaques, or variations, I'm close to them. One of them is, well, I'm changing this first one. I know I'm changing it, but how about this? A king, a real king, doesn't get ulcers. He gives them. A real king does not live under pressure and stress. He creates it for others. Another one that I keep seeing is a form of this that says, lead, follow, or get out of my way, or get out of the way. All right. Does anybody see any connection between those kind of phrases and what should be a revolutionary attitude? And, of course, by all means, do you see that any possible initial pertinence it seems to have out there is beyond our interest? We're not talking about a king out there. Well, though it's true, it's the only reason that people say it, and it's the only reason I bring it up. It is true that a real king, a real powerful person out there, doesn't get ulcers. He gives them, or he wouldn't be powerful. He leading the dance. Whether it's the president of a corporation, whether it's the head of a family, whether it's just a love relationship, whoever's in charge, if he was really in charge, or she, it would be a she, of course, but if they're really in charge, as much as really in charge, as much as really anything can happen in the 3D world when you're always missing at least one always pertinent dimension, but as much as that's possible, if there's a real controlling power, a real king, they don't get ulcers. They don't feel the stress. Contrary, those not in power feel as though you're giving me ulcers. You're the source of the stress. And from that limited view, that's true. Now, internally, everybody, their wired up city self, believes that they are under undue pressure. Many people believe the stress in life is going to kill me. Oh, yeah, they'll finally admit if you point out the obvious, well, yeah, I'm 79, but I bet it's going to get me any day now. And they're probably right. It's probably going to get me any day now. Internally, do you realize if somebody was in charge and you could be it, or at least if he ever got in charge, if you ever got in charge, I can guarantee this, I can teach you how to assassinate him. And I can teach you how to keep Hamlet from hanging around behind the curtain and nobody will know it but you and me. You can take control. If the situation is ever set up that one person is in control, that there is a power in you in control, it won't get ulcers. It doesn't feel the stress. Contrary, as it would appear, it would be the one causing the stress. And now it seems, at least half the time to you, that you're under the stress, that you're going to get the ulcers. Now, if you can jump between metaphors somewhere between you and the full dynamic of life being alive, life is doing that to you. Life is doing that to everybody. It does it to dogs and trees and mountains, except they cannot vocalize it. They don't have words for it. You do, but life is doing it. Life doesn't get ulcers. That's sort of the joke, the humor I find of people worrying why every life does this, of people standing up with beards and suits on, that we're about to destroy the planet. That is, we're about to give life ulcers. You know, the ozone layer is going. We've got too many atomic weapons laying around for them not to accidentally, knowing humanity, for them not to at least accidentally be used, and then, bow, we're going to kill nature and ourselves. What they're saying is, it's the peasants. It's serfs. It's drunkards. Out hanging around the barnyard, getting a few drinks, and saying, hey, let's all get together and give the king ulcers. Hold your breath. Life is not arranged that way. Life is going to give you ulcers. What if there was something in you that rather than, of course, you should know by now, it's not limited to this kind of, apparently, binary choice. But as opposed to you being under this continual pressure, as opposed to you being the one getting ulcers, what if you were suddenly able to be the one giving them? And the one, if you didn't see a connection, the one about lead, follow, get out of the way, can you see that? Is life again expressing itself, its general displeasure for destabilization of the dominant submissive dance over too great a period of time? That sounds like some kind of smartaleck that a king, some smartaleck comment that a king or a business typhoon. Don't write me. I still like it. A business typhoon putting up on his door to all of his employees, to all those that he wants to give ulcers to rather than give it to him, about lead, follow, or get out of the way. That sounds great. Sounds like a man on the move. Kind of guy that, you know, if you know what you're doing, the circumstances are right, hell, he'll follow you. You take the lead. But if that ain't the case right now, then you follow me and I'll take the lead, as nature intended it. Or if neither one of those work, at least get out of the dance. Get out of the game. Get out of my way. I got to press on. Forget listening to, you know, some man, Donald Trump or Ted Turner. Listen to life. That's what life is saying. That it will not stand for. It cannot stand for, and it doesn't, but it's announcing periodically, almost reminding itself, we can't have too many couples staying around, whether a couple be a man or a woman, two men, two women, one guy and a whole nation, one guy and a whole company. We can't have too many dance partners staying around, and suddenly it's like they've dropped hold of each other and they're both staying there and they don't. The temporary destabilization has its limits. It can't be too widespread, and it's like life continuing to remind people. Now, back inside. Who cannot find some potential use in that? Who would not like to take one of Smith to periodically take Jones, or vice versa, and go, you know, you dumb son of a bitch, lead, follow, or get out of my way. But then, a little while later, you're Jones. And you say the same damn thing. It's almost as though everybody can give themselves ulcers. That almost mathematically denies the 3D reality of the king doesn't get ulcers, he gives them. It's like, well, all right, if we didn't have a king, we're just all the people. That we would still be able to give ourselves ulcers. Got an epilogue, so all of you fresh-faced recruits in other towns, other places. All right, if they're gone, goddammit. I've got an excursion that's very serious for everybody, young, old, no matter how long you've been around here. It's quite simple, but I want you to listen, and this is not a request. Of course, none of the excursions are. And you newer people, just because I may not even be in your city or you newer people here. If at times, if you fall into a pattern, and especially something like this, of not doing this, all I've got to do is take any particular note of you, and I can tell it. And I'm going to throw you out. And I mean this in other cities. You think it sounds strange, perhaps, but trust me. I want everyone to do this. And it's this, I want you to forgive someone if anything that I'm about to say applies to you. That there is somebody in your life or somebodies, and I don't care who it is. There is no exemption, mother, father, sister, brother, And in fact, they can be deceased. And I still want you to do this. It can be someone you were in business one time. Or it could be somebody that you just had a passing relationship with. Somebody that sold you a car and you were convinced. There's no doubt, it's beyond question. Somebody cheated you. There's somebody's that you've got a grudge against. You may not have spoken to one of your brothers or sisters for 10 years. You may not have spoken to your mother for 5 years. Everybody hears me. If none of this applies to you, then none of this applies to you. But if there's anybody or anybodies in your life that right now you are estranged with, in the next 5 days, I want you to contact them, and here's how you can do it. This is quite acceptable. This is, in fact, the way I encourage it. Is call them on the telephone. And I don't care. No excuse. No exemptions. And I guess the wiring of people, what would seem to be the hardest, what would seem to be the most astringent situation would be such as your mother or father, or even your children. And if you had children, if there's any grudge going on, any amount of estrangement, whether it's been going on a year or a decade, you got 5 days, and you call them on the phone. You say hello, and you say something to this effect, that I have been, as you might know, mad. I have been, you can leave it at that. I have been mad since I hadn't spoken to you in 10 years for that period of time at you, and I want to call up, and I want to tell you that I've come to a conclusion. I just was suddenly feeling that life is too short for this, and I want to tell you I'm sorry I did that. I'm sorry that I imagine that you had in some way mistreated me. And I just want to tell you, as far as I'm concerned, this grudge has been going on. This estrangement is over. I just wanted to call you and tell you that life is too short. Well, I don't need this. I don't know what you do, but I wanted to tell you I don't need this. And as far as I'm concerned, it's over, and I just wanted to say, hey, and I hope everything's fine. It's very likely, and this is not the point, it's very likely that they'll jump in most cases, and they won't join in some way. You're not obliged to, other than say, yeah, well, I got to go. You're not obliged to do anything after that. I don't care whether you call them again in 10 years. But I want you to do this. And that's no big secret. It's no trick. Just do what I said. Just repeat as much as you can what I said in a fairly good-natured voice. Smile when you pick up the phone. Just stand there by yourself, smile, and do that. And what I want you to do is, at that point, play the part of forgiving them. Mean it as best you can. And then hang up. No, hang up on them, but let the conversation reach some end. You forgive them. That's the point. And you're not obliged to do anything else. I mean that. You're not obliged to follow up. I don't care what you do after that. But in the next 5 days, anybody or anybodies that you got that kind of estrangement from, you call them up and you goddamn forgive them. Of course, you don't put it to them that way. You do more or less what I said, but you forgive them. I absolutely want that done, and I guess I may have to teach some of you a lesson, or even out of town. That'd really teach you a lesson. Some of you people I've never even seen in person. If you don't watch it, I may use this one time that I'll pull out people who did not do it, and I'll send word out of town and here. I'm just going to tell you to get out if you didn't do it. As you forgive everybody that falls in that category in the next 5 days without any exception, no stories, not to yourself. Of course, you wouldn't even dare give them to me, but don't give yourself a story like, well, I can't do that because he doesn't know what my father did to me. I don't care what it is. You don't know the way my children mistreated me. I don't care what in the hell it was. You call up and forgive them on the phone. I suggest that. I'm not telling you to go see them in person if it's a real one, like a decade of non-speaking, that kind of thing. Just call them on the phone and make it as short as possible, as short as you want to. Not being rude, but you forgive them. As far as you're concerned, you forgive them. They'll hear it. That what you're saying is, let's drop this. That's all you're required to do. After that, I don't care what happens. Well, you can't go back and restart it. But of course, there's some dirty tricks involved with this.
That concludes this talk. Be sure to visit us at jancox.com, where you can search through 3,000 talks for topics of interest, or just leave us a message.